This week we're going to talk about a perspective which is quite contemporary, the cognitive science or information processing perspective. In that sense, it stands out from most of the previous lectures, which were dealing with figures who were more historical, like Piaget and Vygotsky. But this is very 21st century cognitive science and information processing. And I'm going to give some historical background to this movement and then describe a few of the current practitioners of a cognitive science or information processing approach to cognitive development. As a background, and to remind us of where we've been previously, we began the course with some weeks on Piaget, and we looked at some theoretical criticisms of Piaget from Vygotsky of the Soviet school and Brunner, we might say, of the contemporary American school. There are also, however, other critiques of Piaget to keep in mind. One is the critique from empiricism. These are criticisms which either take issue of some of Piaget's actual experimental demonstrations, for example, arguing that kids can do things much earlier than Piaget had claimed, or from the point of view of saying that instead of there being cognitive structures which help us make sense of experience, that instead we're much more a reflection of what's going on in the world, with the mind being more of a blank slate or a mirror rather than an active constructive mechanism. And then the opposite kind of critique from nativism or modularity, which we'll come to in the next few weeks, the critique which says that actually we're built with a lot of knowledge. That's what the claim of nativism is, not just functional invariants like assimilation and accommodation, but actual knowledge, so to speak. And the critique from modularity, which says that rather than having a single kind of general computer information processing device, we have more specific kinds of computers which are evolved to deal with language or music or spatial perception or things like that. And you will see some of these struggles, theoretical, empirical, and nativistic modular critiques of Piaget in the arguments which take place in the cognitive science approach, though I won't touch on all of them explicitly today. The cognitive revolution is often said to have begun in September of 1956. Of course, it began in Cambridge, Massachusetts, where all important events begin. And there was, in fact, a meeting at MIT with some of the characters listed here attended, where perhaps for the first time, people working in computers, in psychology, and linguistics had a feeling they were really dealing with the same new set of views, which are called the cognitive revolution or the cognitive scientific views. But this realization would not have taken place if there hadn't been very important technical achievements in the 1930s and 40s. And any cognitive history has to single out the important work on computers done in the United States and in England during the 1930s and 1940s. For those of us who are remote from computers, it's important to realize that computers were essentially invented on paper before they were invented mechanically. That is, there were certain mathematical insights, certain logical insights, certain understandings about the nature of information, so to speak, which were arrived at by people who just sat at a table and wrote out numbers or symbols of other sorts. And it was because of their particular contributions that shortly afterwards people said, well, maybe we can take these ideas and we can realize them mechanically. That is, if computing is a certain kind of mathematical operation, and computing isn't just adding, or it's not just adding numbers, it's taking symbols and doing things to those symbols, maybe we can create machines which can do things with symbols as well. Some of you will know about Charles Babbage, who was an English mathematician and inventor who lived in the middle of the 19th century. And he actually had the whole idea of computers, and he tried for 30 years to build computers. He didn't succeed, though he made what we might call adding machines now. But what happened was that in a sense, Babbage's dream and the dreams of certain other people from even the 18th century and 19th century came true in the middle of the 20th century because of Claude Shannon's work on the nature of information, bits of information, what we now think of as the ones and zeros which can underlie any message, and the work of Alan Turing, who was working on the fundamentals of mathematics and the relationship between mathematics and logic, and who realized that if you could state anything clearly, you could create a machine which would do the steps that are needed to carry out that particular operation. Turing is also famous in the more popular world for having realized that the real test of whether a machine could think was if you sat in a room and you queried a machine and you queried a human being, could you tell which was the machine and which was the human being, or which perhaps we should say which was the mechanical machine and which was the blood and guts machine. And you know, computers are getting pretty good. Those of us who were skeptical 20 years ago have a harder time remaining skeptical nowadays. And John von Neumann, who's probably the name most likely to be known by people here, was a mathematician from Hungary who'd come to America and was actually involved in the buildings of the first computers, one of which eventually became called JOHNIAC after him because he was John von Neumann and he deserved to have a computer named after him. So that's what was going on in the area, we might say, of math, logic, and the very first computers, which were basically glorified adding machines. They just crunched numbers very, very quickly. Indeed, going back as early as 1948 and 1952, and I go back that far, you could watch election night returns, and they had these huge computers which would predict who's going to win or not, and these were numerical kinds of projections. Now they interview three people coming out of a voting booth in California, and they tell you what's going to happen, but in those days it was a bigger deal. Carl Lashley was a Harvard professor who was a leading behaviorist. He was not a crazy behaviorist in the sense of believing you could make anything out of anybody, as the most flagrant behaviorists were. But he was somebody who basically spent his life studying rats and was trying to understand the ways that rats made their way around the world. And stimulus response kinds of explanations were very appealing to Lashley. He was actually a student of Watson, who was the founder of behaviorism in America. One of the ironies of science is the best thing for science is wars. Wars actually create scientific advances, not just things like atomic bombs, but like radar, cybernetics, which was the theory of computing. These all come out of wars. And Lashley benefited from the wars of the middle 20th century because scholars of different sorts were being brought together in the late 40s to talk about what was being learned about human beings from the point of view of brain, from the point of view of psychology, from the point of view of machines that could think. And in 1948, Lashley gave a very, very important paper called The Role of Serial Order in Behavior, serial being spelled S-E-R-I-A-L. And I write about that paper in my book, The Mind's New Science. And basically what happened in that paper was that Lashley conceded, C-O-N-C-E-D-E-D, that there were all sorts of important things about human behavior which couldn't be explained in terms of a strict stimulus-response chain because they involved planning, and you could tell by the way a person behaved that in fact they had the whole notion of what they wanted to do in mind before they actually began to behave. A good example of that is a slip of the tongue where you actually anticipate a word that's coming at the end of the sentence that comes in the beginning, and this has been studied. And of course, you wouldn't have made that slip if you didn't really know where the sentence was going. You have a plan for the whole sentence. This is very hard to explain with stimulus response because actually each word is supposed to trigger the next word. And the notion that you could have had a whole plan is very hard to explain that way. Lashley was also a musician, and he talked about how you had slips of the violin or the piano where, again, you knew where you were going to go, and that structured the way that you actually played something. Moreover, he also pointed out that something like an arpeggio goes by so quickly that you can't possibly have each note trigger the next one. The whole plan has to be there in the beginning. And even though it was not at all Lashley's goal to undermine behaviorism, he probably died a behaviorist in 1960, the questions he raised about serial order, the order in which things happen, and particularly the way things happen in language, was a very, very searching critique of the whole SR approach, the whole stimulus response approach to the understanding of human behavior and, of course, of thought. And the fact that this was said by a behaviorist rather than somebody who wasn't a psychologist was very, very important. It's often said in politics that a Democratic president could never have gone to China and tried to link up with China in the 1970s, but Richard Nixon, who was known as being an anti-communist and a foe of China, he was able to go with Henry Kissinger and begin to speak with Mao Zedong and Zhou Enlai. Similarly, because Lashley was willing to say behaviorism can't possibly explain the most important thing about human beings, namely their speech and language, the fact that he was saying that was terribly, terribly important. Noam Chomsky, a name that you know, and you'll know more about, I hope, after the next lecture, was very influenced by Lashley's paper. Lashley's paper came out when Chomsky was 20, was published when he was 23. By the time Chomsky was 27 years of age, he'd already worked out his basic linguistic ideas, and his basic linguistic ideas were actually a mathematical proof that language could not operate in what's called a finite state machine, where each state dictates what's going to happen next. It has to involve much more planning, going backward and forth, flexibility, and so on. Who are the other folks there? Well, we know Bruner. Bruner was doing something then called the Cognition Project at Harvard, where he focused on strategies that people use to solve problems. The whole notion of strategies was something that you couldn't espouse if you were a behaviorist, because that suggested that you had a plan about how you were going to try something out, and that wasn't working, you're going to try something else out. It was much, much too reflective for behaviorists. George Miller was a psycholinguist who worked very closely with Chomsky. A famous Harvard story is that Miller was reading Chomsky's path-breaking book, Syntactic Structures, in 1956, the year of the beginning of the cognitive revolution, when Memorial Hall burnt down, and the psychology department was in the basement of Memorial Hall, and according to the legend, Miller grabbed Chomsky's Syntactic Structures and ran out of the building, saving it, who knows if it was the only copy or not, for another day. Miller and Bruner grouped together in 1960 to start something called the Center for Cognitive Studies at Harvard. It lasted only 10 years, but it was extraordinarily important for everybody working in cognitive psychology, because they all passed through there and gave talks, and many of them came and spent a year there. I actually, as a student, was connected with the Center for Cognitive Studies. It's a very good, so to speak, focus for a lot of the important activity which we still live off of today, was incubated in the Center for Cognitive Studies in William James Hall, which is where psychology went after Memorial Hall burned down. Both of those men are alive now in their 80s. The other two individuals to mention were Herb Simon and Alan Newell. Newell was, I believe, a mathematician and engineer. Simon has a very long history, actually. Was a political scientist turned psychologist, but won the Nobel Prize in economics, deservedly, not because he's the best economist, but because he's so good they had to give him some Nobel Prize, and since he wasn't going to get it for peace or literature, they settled on giving it to him in economics. But while Herbert Simon didn't coin the word artificial intelligence, I think it was coined by John McCarthy at Stanford, he really is the person who deserves the most credit for having developed the field of artificial intelligence. As the name implies, intelligence done by machines, not by human beings. And artificial intelligence is probably the sine qua non discipline for the cognitive sciences. If we hadn't had computers and the attempt to have computers think via artificial intelligence, you probably wouldn't have had a cognitive revolution. Bruner and Miller would have gone on and done their work, and Chomsky would have done his work. The other point here in the brief history of the cognitive revolution I've already touched on, namely behaviorism, the psychology of choice, both in the United States and in the then Soviet Union, probably crested in the 1930s and had a period of stability in the 40s. It was being carried through at Harvard by Skinner, who was the most famous behaviorist. But By the time the middle 50s were around, the best students, and you always have to look at what the best students are doing to know what the future is, the best students were realizing that behaviorism was spent, and they began to gravitate to places like the Center of Cognitive Studies at Harvard or Linguistics Department at MIT, where Chomsky was, or Simon Newell, who'd been for 40 years at Carnegie Mellon. Newell died a few years ago. Simon is still active at 85. And we'll talk about this more next week, but the so-called coup de grace to behaviorism came in a startlingly cruel review of Skinner's book about language, a book called Verbal Behavior, written by Chomsky, published in 1959, this very critical review. And basically anybody who read the review and took it seriously realized there was no way that behaviorism could ever explain language. Lashley had understood this intuitively. Chomsky proved it to you in ways that you had to be pretty resistant not to get. Skinner always claimed he'd never read the review. I'm sure that's not true, but if he said he never read the review, he wouldn't have to answer it, and that was probably a wise thing for him to do, because there really was no answer to the most salient points in the review. Like Lashley's paper, the review is a good paper to read. Both of them are quite widely available, but for those who don't have time, there are potted versions of both in the Mind's New Science. So what is cognitive science? There are four things I'm going to mention very quickly, and the fifth thing I'm going to focus on because it's the most important for our purposes. The first thing, and this is really part of my definition of cognitive science comes out of the most basic philosophical questions which we take from the Greeks. What is knowledge? How do we know? How do we remember? How do we learn? How do we make sense of the world? What does it mean to understand? What does it mean to be logical, creative, and so on? These are very basic philosophical questions. Plato, Socrates, Aristotle talked about them. Cognitive science attempts to give empirical answers to those questions. It tends to say we really can define what knowledge is. We know it, we can see it, we can write models of it, we can make machines that know. So it's a very daring claim. My teacher, Nelson Goodman, always used to say that a cognitive psychologist is just a philosopher with a research grant. And we might say that philosophers now who want to answer the questions they've asked for 2,500 years are very interested in what cognitive scientists discover, even though, as we'll see at the end of the lecture, sometimes they're very skeptical about it as well. So cognitive science grows out of philosophical questions. The second point, point number three, is that computers are very central. In a trivial sense, they're central because everybody now works on computers, whether they're word processing or crunching data or developing mathematical models or doing neural networks. So the computer is the tool of choice, where a pencil and paper or an adding machine or a slide rule would have been the tool of choice in earlier times. But the computer is more central in that it's given us a whole new way of thinking about our own human cognition. Namely, we are a computer, or we have a computer in us, or we have lots of computers in us. These are all different claims that different people make. And not just to make a statement that in some vague sense we're computers, but how do those computers work? And if we can build computers, either in software or hardware, that actually work and do things, then that may give us hints about how we do things ourselves. An important terminological distinction is if you're engaged in simulation, this means you're actually trying to get the machine to do things the way we do it. If you're an artificial intelligence, you're just trying to get the machine to do it smartly. I mean, so let's take chess, not a random example. Probably half of all the work done in artificial intelligence has been in chess because it's such a sign of smartness in human beings. If you're trying to simulate human chess playing, then basically the chess program has got to make the same kinds of mistakes that human beings make, and it has to reason in the same way they reason, humans reason. It's very hard. I don't think anybody's built a chess program which is anywhere like the way human beings do it. Certainly not a traditional chess program. I don't know about neural network programs. But let's say you just want a computer to be able to beat you in chess. That's a pretty good target for a smart computer, and you don't care how it does it. That's artificial intelligence. That's not simulation. And there are two kinds of artificial intelligence. One is the brute force one. Let's say the computer can do a billion steps every second, and so it can think of as many steps as there are atoms in the universe in 5 minutes, that's probably one way it can get to beat you in chess, because it thinks of every other possibility and just picks the best one. That's a brute force one. But there are much cleverer ways in which computers can work. They may not be the way we do. They may even be smarter than we are, because they can remember better, or because they can remember more about how somebody else played than we can. But that would be a kind of a smart artificial intelligence as opposed to a brute force artificial intelligence. Cognitive science, by and large, has avoided issues of affect. They are wet. They are messy. Cognitivists don't quite know what to do with affect. So even though there are some efforts to deal with affect, they tend to be very cognitive efforts to deal with affect. They tend to be efforts which cognitivize it, so to speak. I'll touch to this point when I discuss Robbie Case later. I think probably the most interesting of the information processing psychologists, he has a tendency to convert everything into number, because number is the way that he can study it. So when he studies affect, he right away converts it into good and bad, two properties, or mean, very mean, not so mean, kind, converting it into four points in a continuum, and then he can deal with it. But if affect doesn't work that way, then the cognitive approach to affect, or you might say a computational way of thinking about affect, may just be inappropriate. Final point on the list is that while everybody, even cognitivists, pay lip service to context, namely, you can't just look at a behavior, you've got to see how it fits in with other behaviors, you've got to understand why somebody's doing it, what their environment is, and so on. The truth is that context is very messy. We don't know how to represent it. Where does context stop? Is it with my parents, my grandparents, the whole world? What's my context? Much too difficult to compute, so therefore we try to cleave it out. At MIT, they used to hand out pencils with the legend on them, "Context sucks." That's a technical term. What it basically means is, if you want to understand language, try to understand a sentence at a time. If you worry about what was said before and what somebody's really trying to achieve and whether they're being indirect and things like that, you're never getting it anywhere. So a cat is on the mat should mean just that, no more or no less. The final point, and the key one for anybody who's trying to understand a cognitive approach, is the recognition of the importance of the representational level. If you wanted to say this completely in lay terms, you would say it is a recognition that people have ideas, that ideas really exist, in an effort to explain what it means to have an idea. Now, that doesn't sound very controversial until you realize two things. First of all, behaviorists didn't want to talk about ideas. I've always thought that Chomsky's famous sentence, "Colorless green ideas sleep furiously," was kind of an attack on behaviorism, because ideas aren't supposed to exist, and yet they changed the world. And the other thing about the notion of the representational level is that there isn't just a single way to think about ideas. We have to ask our question, when we think about an idea, is how are we going to describe them? What's the language in which we're going to describe ideas? What is, so to speak, the language of mental representation? How do we describe an idea? As long as I say idea, everybody knows what I mean. But what is it really? What is it in the mind brain? What is there to be an idea? And that's the heartland of cognitive science. There's disputes among people about how do we think about what ideas are, or what are ideas. So to jump ahead, but to give a kind of an intuitive example, most people think there's a single kind of intelligence. So that means that people who have very intelligence can compute ideas very well. Howard Gardner thinks there are lots of different kinds of intelligence. Maybe that means we have different kinds of mental representations, and that to represent the world in images is different than to represent it in words or in numbers or some other kind of way. So that's what the struggle about representational level is all about. A distinction which I've very recently found useful in my own thinking is to talk about the representational level syntactically and semantically. Semantically is, in a sense, easy to describe. It's the meaning or the content. So if you have an idea, what's the idea about? Let's say it's the idea is about a warm summer vacation or a pleasant summer vacation. That's the idea. We all know about that. That's the semantic. That's the content of the idea. But the syntax is, how do we go about having that idea? What does our mind have to do? Do we see a picture in our mind? Do we hear a word and refer to some kind of a thesaurus or lexicon? What are the actual processes we do so that we can understand the semantic content of a warm summer afternoon? And if you think about my multiple intelligences, I would argue that those are basically syntactic. They're basically ways of information processing. We can process language in terms of streams and strands and sounds and so on. But what gives language meaning is that it exists in the world, a world of objects and events which we can recognize and which we can relate to that language. So at a first approximation then, representation level is about ideas. It's acknowledgement we have them. It's a hypothesis that there can be a science which describes those ideas with some clarity. And as the first cut in, we might say, what is the syntax of those ideas and what is the semantics of those ideas? A whole different way to think about the representational level is to think about what's a university and what's the... It used to be a physical catalog. I guess now it's mostly a virtual catalog. And everybody agrees that we need to study the world, the physical world, the world of science, the world of biology and chemistry and physics. What's the world made out of in a material sense? And everybody agrees that we need to be able to study history and culture and art, because that's sort of, we might say that's the world of ideas themselves, and it's also what gives meaning to life. But the question posed by the cognitive scientist, is there something else that should be in the catalog? Namely, the study of how minds, animal minds, human minds, computer minds, represent everything. Is that a separate course of study, something that's valid? Now, obviously, I think so, and probably many of you would think so as well. But actually, the cognitivists have been muscling to get their way at the table, because the materialists, the physicalists, they're already at the table. They want to explain everything, let's say, by the atom or by the cell or by the gene. And then the culturists, they're already at the table, because that's what the universe has been about ever since it got started in Plato's time. But for those of us who are interested in how the mind works and how it thinks, we got to fight to get our way in the table. Really, actually, for the reasons we talked about with Vygotsky and Pavlov and Bekhterev. Namely, remember the struggle in Russia, the 19th century Russia, between the idealists. Those are the historians and culturalists. It's all ideas. And the materialists, the reflexologists, it's all what happens when stimulus and response get together. And Vygotsky had a fight to say, no, there's meaning in consciousness, and that deserves a place on the table too. The cognitives are fighting the same fight, but because we or they have computers on their side, they're more likely to win, because nobody can push computers to the side the way they might be able to push the zone of proximal development or Piaget's schemas to the side. So that's the intellectual background of cognitive science. And it's actually, to be honest, more important for all of you to understand that than it is to understand the specifics of theories, which we're going to get to now. Because the specifics of theories you'll understand when you pore over them, and I'll help you a bit, though they're not the kinds of things which are easiest to lecture about. But it's really the nature of the enterprise of trying to think systematically about what ideas are, and then trying to build a science of that. So when Mike has an idea about whether two beakers have the same amount of liquid in them, or when Kim has an idea about whether somebody who breaks a lot of things when he's trying to do good work is more culpable than somebody who breaks only one thing when he's up to no good, to be able to think about how people think about those issues, that's the core question of mental representation. And, you know, people would still disagree about how much progress has been made, but clearly there are a lot of very serious people who think it's an enterprise worth being engaged in. Here are some more milestones. The real work in cognitive science began in the middle of the 50s with a series of computer programs devised at Carnegie Mellon by Herb Simon and Alan Newell. And the most famous of that is called the GPS, or General Problem Solver. And this was a computer program which, as the name implied, was to be able to solve all kinds of problems. Now, it's revealing what the problems were that it solved. It basically solved three kinds of problems. Chess problems, the sort we talked about. Logical problems, actually proving logical theorems, which is a thing to do if you're got a logical cast of mind, and a funny game called cryptarithmetic, where letters refer to numbers. If you look in airline magazines, they often have a sum, two add ends, and a sum, all in letters, and you've got to figure out what number each letter leads to so the thing makes sense. Those are the kinds of problems that GPS worked on. They were perfectly sensible problems, but with the benefit of hindsight, you can see lots of problems which GPS would not have been able to handle very well. And the basic idea of GPS was you had what you might call a beginning state, which was the statement of the problem, and then you had a set of specifications of what a solution to the problem should look like. And the goal of GPS was systematically, because it's a computer and it behaves in a total systematic way, namely the way you programmed it to behave, was consistently to reduce the distance between the original statement of the problem and the form the problem had to have to be solved. Like in cryptarithmetic, it works. When you call M a 3 and N a 2 and P a 1 and S a 0, when you put that in, the sum actually works. And so at each step to anthropomorphize, the GPS says to itself, gee, am I closer to the solution? Am I closer to the end form? If so, I got to keep going. If not, I got to go another way. And that's the heartland of GPS. Naturally, if you're doing solving of a logical proof, you have to say, is the proof being solved, or have I been able to prove it can't be solved? If you're doing chess, it's, you know, am I getting rid of the other guy's men or queen, or is the other guy beating me? So that's the basic idea of the general problem solver, and there's a huge book which lays out all the successes of the GPS. However, nobody uses GPS anymore for two reasons. One, they discovered, the artificial intelligentsia, that in fact what computers didn't need was a few very general ways of solving problems. It needed a lot of what we call domain-specific knowledge, namely to solve problems about chemical assaying is very different than solving problems about how to write a fugue or how to diagnose a medical illness. And unless you give a lot of content, to use my term, of the computer, it's never going to get very far. The general problem solver was carefully contrived to solve the kinds of problems where these very general strategies worked. But absent content, like what are a lot of good games that have been played in chess and what can we learn from them, it didn't get very far. And when you give the computer knowledge about the domain of chess, you're actually making it into a what's called an expert system. Nonetheless, that's where it got all started, and that's why there is a cognitive revolution. Until about 1980, and that's kind of where I am and where this lecture is, almost all of the work that was done was worked on what Alan Newell and Herbert Simon called symbolics or symbol systems. What this means is that from the point of view of talking about these programs, they involved statements and propositions or strings of numbers to which you did things, and the things that you did either helped you get a solution or didn't, or proved the solution couldn't be gotten. So it's very much the way you would think about algebra or about basic logic, so to speak, P's and Q's doing things to one another. Computers still work that way, but starting in the middle 80s, there was a very large movement which has various names, and these are not identical, but for our purposes they will do. They were all critical of the notion of the human mind as basically a symbol chunking or symbol processing machine. They said that's not really a good way to think about human cognition in general. Or maybe they said, look, it's not a bad way to think about language, but it's not a good way to think about perception or concept formation. And instead, it took a much more bottom-up approach where you simply had links made to entities which co-occurred, and the more they co-occurred, the stronger the links were, and the less they co-occurred, the weaker the links were. And this is the way we think the brains work, through associations, through connections. And you can build logical systems which also work that way, called neural networks. They're called neural networks because we hope that neurons work like that, but they're actually they're mathematical creations, and you could do neural networks even if we didn't have brains. It's just a way of pinning down what happens in a system which follows certain regularities. Better word to say regularities than rules, because rules is already kind of has the air of symbolics. Anyway, you will have exercises which give you a feeling both for what a classical symbol processing propositional sentence-like approach to computing is like, and one much more based on just seeing lots of examples, and each example makes one output less likely than another output. And as the examples accumulate, you have knowledge. You have percepts, concepts, maybe language. You'll get a feeling for each of those endeavors in the next weeks. The fourth point here is a much more parochial one, but it's important because it represents the first effort to apply what we call an information processing approach to the area of cognitive development. I haven't really talked about this yet, but by the time cognition came to people in psychology, it came an approach which is often called, rather disrespectfully, boxology. And the idea is that the mind is a set of boxes which do various kinds of things, and you get input into those boxes, and the input might be kept in a short-term storage for a while. It might be put into a long-term memory for a while. It might be computed in various ways, plus one, plus two. That doesn't mean adding one or two, but different operations like reversing it or squaring it or putting it in a sentence or something like that. And after enough connections are made among these different boxes, you come out with some kind of output. And the reason that boxology isn't just a pure invention is because, in fact, you can think about computers that way. Computers, of course, have to get data, and they do stuff to the data, including storing it for a while or storing it for a long time or being able to draw on it or changing it according to certain rules which are already built into the program. The program has rules of what to do with certain kinds of data. So whether you're dealing with a rat or an infant or a grown-up, you can think about their mind-brain in a boxological kind of way. Pasquale Leone was a psychiatrist who worked with Piaget, and he said, you know, maybe what happens with development is you get more computational space. And that's a metaphor, but what it means is there's more room with which to work on the information that you have. It might be memory. It might be enhanced memory. You might say more cells. It might be better attention. You can attend more, or you can focus better. It might be more computational muscle in the sense that you become able to do computations you haven't done before. But the notion of this M space was we should be able to quantify it, just as with a computer, you know, whether you have 64 bytes or 64 megabytes or kilobytes or whatever, that's a quantification of how much power the computer has. Well, maybe what happens in development is we get more computing power, which for his own purpose he called M space. It seems pretty primitive now, and Pasquale Leone's own particular work never got that far. But the notion that we could think about a child's mind as a computer that gets better with age, and to describe in which way the computer gets better, that was an insight. And Piaget was too old at that time to become a full-fledged computer fan himself, because he was 75 by the year 1970 when Pasquale Leone was publishing. But I have no doubt that Piaget would have loved this sort of thing, because he really loved, as a French thinker from Switzerland, to try to think about things in as precise and clear way as possible. And computers, as we all know, are the ultimate superego for being precise in thinking, because anytime you do something wrong, you just get an error message. And Pasquale Leone was the pioneer, and he had a very good student named Robbie Case, which is one of the reasons he's on this slide. And here's Robbie Case himself. Now, Robbie Case was a friend and colleague who died quite suddenly in the year 2000, in May of 2000, I believe. And he was a student of Pasquale Leone, became very interested in thinking about the child's mind as a computer. And what he really tried to do was to cognitivize in the cognitive science sense, or information processize in the sense of boxology, Piaget. He took most of Piaget's demonstrations. He didn't really argue very much with Piaget's stages. He didn't worry a lot about Piaget's structures. He had his own way of talking about structures. But basically, and I don't know if Case ever said this to himself directly, and alas, we can't ask him anymore. Basically, I think that what he said to himself is, now that we know about computing and information processing, can we recreate Piaget in that spirit, and can we make it much more precise and measurable and computable? And Case carried this program forward without, I think, losing sight of the grander Piaget enterprise. In that sense, he's somewhat analogous to Annette Carmeloff-Smith, who is also someone we studied in this course. Kurt Fischer, who will be lecturing here, took the computer example less seriously than Robbie Case. David Klar and his colleague Wallace actually took it more seriously than Robbie Case, perhaps too seriously, you might say. But these were all people who we're talking about today who basically took Piaget's problems, being problems he was interested in, and I've listed the two ones that Robbie Case spoke the most about here, and used the insights we have from computers to try to make Piaget more rigorous, you might say more testable, more empirical. Almost everybody who studies in the Piagetian tradition likes the balance beam. The balance beam, you know, is a plank of wood and a fulcrum, typically right in the middle, and you put weights on the two sides, and if you put the right number of weights in the right place, the beam will balance, but if you have more weights on one side or the other, or stuff is further away from the fulcrum on one side and the other, that becomes a factor on whether or not the scale will balance. And I think we all have an intuition for that. I mentioned in another lecture that Annette Carmeloff-Smith played a dirty trick on kids. She put unbalanced blocks on balanced beams, which meant if you just assumed all the blocks had the same weight, then you would not get the answer right. And you'd have to realize that Annette Carmeloff-Smith had played a trick on you. But for the purposes of the examples today, this is not a trick. If you know how many blocks there are on each side and how many steps they are from the fulcrum, then you can determine a priori whether the scale will balance or whether it will tip to one side or the other. Another problem, which Robbie Case was in love with, and nobody else seems to use it, is called the Nolting problem, because some guy named Nolting or some woman named Nolting came up with it. And it's basically a problem about juiciness. You know, we all drink orange juice or stuff like that, and orange juice can have too much orange juice in it so it's too sweet, or it can have too much water in it so it's kind of liquidy and not very good. And in the Nolting problem, you give kids lots of glasses with pure juice and lots of glasses with water, and you mix them up and you say which is going to be sweeter than which. And clearly, the more orange juice per cubic centimeter, the sweeter it's going to be, but kids don't understand that, so they make interesting kinds of errors. They may just look at how much orange juice there is without any reference to how much water there is. I mean, if there's three glasses filled with orange juice and one with water, and you mix them all together, it's going to be a heck of a lot sweeter than if you have three glasses of orange juice and 47 glasses of water. But kids, when they're young, don't pay attention to that. They just pay attention to how many glasses of juice there are. Well, whether Case is talking about balance beams or waters or kids reaching for hidden objects or people doing conservation of number, he says you got to think about this the way a computer programmer would. Namely, what's the situation you're faced with? What's the task? What are you trying to achieve? And what do you do to achieve that goal? So let's say you're trying to make an orange juice of a certain degree of sweetness. This is playing a bit with Nolting. You say, I want to have a sweet glass of orange juice. That's my objective. The situation is I got lots of glasses of orange juice and lots of glasses of water here. And then how do I go about making a glass which has exactly the right degree of sweetness? That would be the strategy I use to attain the goal. And really important point about psychology, which I'm sure I will make more than once in this lecture, is psychology is basically the study of tasks. Everything we do, we try to break down to a task, because that's what we can do in 15 minutes in the lab. Moreover, whenever possible, we try to think of it in terms of a problem which can be solved and a goal reached. And we're very good at that. And as long as you think that's what life consists in, then you're home free. However, I mean, a basic critique I would make about psychology is it's not good at dealing with things which don't lend themselves to that. I mean, somebody spending his life trying to write a good novel, you don't get much mileage by talking about the situation, the objective, and the goal. It's kind of irrelevant. And in fact, what's the problem? the problem is to write a good novel. It's not something that you can make any progress with. So psychologists don't write about what it takes to write a good novel. We talk about how to get a sweet glass of orange juice because we can look in 15 minutes at how people do that, and we can systemize it in the Robbie Case way. Or we say, can the child predict whether the balance beam will balance, or can we child get the balance beam to balance? In Karmeloff Smith's case, she's seeing whether the kids actually can get the balance, and they fail if the bricks themselves are unbalanced. In the Case Siegler examples we'll be talking about today, the kids don't do anything. They just predict whether or not the beam will balance. Now, Robbie Case lays out a bunch of stages, and in your reading, you will find these stages laid out. I'm not going to run through them at all today. I'm going to characterize them instead. There are four stages, and they map just about perfectly onto Piaget's four stages. The first one is the sensory motor stage. The second one is the pre-operational or semiotic or representational stage. The third one is the concrete operational stage. And the fourth one is the formal operational stage. And if you know what those stages are, you can pretty much guess what it is that Robbie means by these four terms. And you might say that Kurt's stages, which he calls tiers, correct, also map onto these, roughly speaking. And while Kurt has a bunch of levels within tiers, Robbie Case has a bunch of steps within each of these major stages. And the intuition behind both Case and Fisher is very simple. Basically, you have something alone, then you have two things alone, then you connect the two things, and then you create an ensemble. And when you create an ensemble, that becomes the input to the beginning of the higher tier or level or stage, whatever you want to call it. And so in each case, they're taking the broad Piagetian system and they're translating it into their own preferred metaphor. Robbie's preferred metaphor is control structures. How do we deal with dimensions in terms of control structure? Kurt's metaphor is skills. How do we connect and integrate and coordinate skills? It would require a conversation, which alas we can no longer have, between Robbie Case and Kurt Fisher to know at which point each of them would disagree with a substantive claim about what goes on, say, in balance beams or the Nolting problem or nice mean, to use one of Kurt's favorite examples. But certainly from a certain distance, they're engaged in very similar kinds of enterprises. Robbie Case is the theorist who I believe it's most important to try to understand if you're doing cognitive development from an information processing point of view. Here are some other things to perhaps help you enter the world of Case. One is that his the issues he investigates are almost entirely taken from Piaget. And even when he takes things which are not taken from Piaget, like when I say media, I mean he looks at things like drawing and stories, which Piaget didn't look at very much. But he looks at it in terms of, in a story, how many characters are there and how do they relate to each other? Or in drawing, is there one baseline or are there two baselines? So in my sense, as I said earlier, he tends to quantify them. And in development is how many dimensions can the person work with and how well can the person integrate dimensions. That's fine if the essence of narrative is really how many characters can you deal with. But if the essence of narrative is drama or setting, or characterization, or a tragic ending, then it's less clear that this approach to narrative really gets at the substance of narrative. And similarly with drawing, if it's use of color or how expressed the drawing is or how unusual the drawing is, you're not going to get that if you simply look at how many characters are in the drawing and whether they're all laid out in one baseline or whether there's a sense of space. So the beauty is also the weakness. The beauty is you quantify these things. The weakness is that stuff doesn't lend itself to quantification. It tends to get lost in the shuffle. And because Robbie was a very fair-minded person, he recognized this. As a student of Pasquale Leone, Robbie Case spent a lot of time trying to quantify this M space, this storage space. What was it? How big was it? What was it made out of? Here we get into issues of mental representation. What does it mean to have a lot of computing space? The big arguments are, one, does the space actually get bigger in any kind of sense, like there's more neurons, or is it the same amount of space, but we learn to use it more efficiently because, to use the usual terms, things get automatized, and so they can be done using less computing. I mean, if I ask you to add 7 and 9, it's not a big deal, but when you were 6, it was a big deal, and it took all your computing space to do it. Now, you know, you can probably flip a coin or sing a song at the same time. It doesn't take much computing space at all. And so the question is it a question of more space, and if so, where does the space come from? Are there more brain cells? Are there larger cavities? Are there better connections among different parts of the brain? Or is it simply that you've just learned to use the space better, so it seems like there's more available to operate on? And the same thing would apply in computers. I mean, you can simply buy more memory, or you can organize things in memory in such a way that there's a lot of memory that's left over if you know how to classify your data properly. In the last decade of his life, kind of an interesting parallel to Piaget, who also made concessions in the last decade of his life to a more domain-specific or modular point of view, Robbie Case came up with a notion which he called central conceptual structures. And you have that present in your reading. And central conceptual structures was an effort to find a middle ground between the very general Piaget systems, where you have one operational system which matures and it becomes capable of more and more complicated kinds of groupings. That's the classical Piaget tradition. And the extreme modular position, which says we have a lot of different independent information processing devices and one has nothing to do with the other. It would be multiple intelligences point of view extended to maybe 500 different computers rather than half a dozen. What Robbie Case said is, yes, the sphere of number is not the same as the sphere of space and is not the same as the sphere of what he would call events, things that happen in stories, in doll play, or in real life. And so we need to have a somewhat different cognitive system to work with number than with space or with events. And he certainly opened up the possibility of there being more than three conceptual structures, though these were the ones that he himself studied. However, he remained a Piagetian in his heart, au fond, as the Piagetians might say, because he believed that the limits of each of these separate conceptual structures were still determined by how much computing space you had, how powerful your executive control structures were, how many dimensions you could deal with. So we might say that these were family variants of the same general overall Piagetian case approach. But as a concession to the modularists, Case conceded that in a practical level, somebody might be more fluent with number or be better able to deal with number than with space or with events, though a ceiling would always be set by the amount of computing power available. A final point, an important point, is that almost all cognitivists now speculate about education. And this is entirely different from when I was a student 30 years ago, when we never ever talked about education. There was William James Hall, and there was the Ed School, and never the twain shall meet. Robbie Case did more than simply speculate. He also did some very good work in the area of education. This work is called The Construction of a Number Line. A number line is just what the name implies. For most people, it's zero to big. Big number. I mean, you know, for more sophisticated, it's negative numbers to infinity or negative infinity to positive infinities. But for most people, it's 1, 2, 3, 4, and then we might say lots. The number line includes that you go +1 in one direction, -1 in another. Now, Robbie Case's analysis said that you couldn't really progress with anything in school unless you had a number line. The interesting finding that he made was that most middle-class kids, just as they know about literacy, even if they can't read and write, already understood about number lines before they came to school. There was something in their environment which made them understand that 3 and 4s were the names of quantities, and 4 was more than 3, and you could add 1 to 4, et cetera, et cetera. So they had a number line. Kids who didn't have a number line were absolutely clueless in school, because teachers meaning perfectly well, assumed everybody had a number line, because how could you not have that kind of number line? Just like we might assume everybody who looks in a book and hears a person read realizes they're making sense of the squiggles. But perhaps, if you didn't know about reading, you would think the person was just making it up, and the squiggles were kind of drawing. So what Robbie Case did together with Sharon Griffin was essentially to help underprivileged kids, disadvantaged kids, construct a number line in the early months of school, so they would be equal with the kids who, so to speak, came to school with a lunchbox and a number line. And what he found was once the kids had the number line, they were able to keep up with the other kids. Whereas, of course, kids who didn't have the number line, because the parents hadn't given it to them and the teachers assumed they had them, just fell further and further behind. Because the number line doesn't come for free, it needs to be scaffolded. So that's, if you said to me, you know, what are important real educational things that cognitive psychologists have done, Robbie Case would be one of the very few that I could think of. Kurt Fischer will speak for himself. He will be here giving a lecture, and also we will spend a section or two talking about his work. This slide actually is not exactly a prediction of what's going to happen for the rest of the lecture, because we're not going to talk about Bob Sternberg, because there isn't time. Instead, we're going to talk about another Bob named Bob Siegler, for whom we've made time, and also about Claren Wallis, whom I've mentioned earlier. Sticking to information processing in general for a moment, how can we compare information processing in general with the major theories we've looked at beforehand, Piaget and Vygotsky? Here are four points that I would make. And I'm not talking so much about Case here. I'm talking more about Claren, Wallis, and Siegler, whom we're about to come to. This is why this slide is here. First of all, the computing model is taken much more literally, actually an attempt to figure out what's being stored and how much and so on. Second of all, there isn't much interest in the kinds of structures that Piaget wrote about. The bias is very functional in the way we spoke about, namely, how can you actually get this to work, whether it's in a human person or in a computer, how can you get us to the right answer? There's less of a commitment to actual stages and structures. If you read Siegler and Claren, Wallis and Sternberg, you don't read very much about stages and structures. And particularly in comparison to Vygotsky, there's less interest in contextual issues. We're still thinking about the individual child or the individual computer in human skin trying to grind out solutions to problems like the balance beam or conservation of number or the Nolting juice problem. We're not very much concerned with the dynamics among human beings. For the obvious reason, that's too hard to simulate in a computer, at least now. We wouldn't know how to simulate what a group of people doing together on a problem or a teacher helping a student could do. So we do it very much more the student on his or her own. Last, the Carnegie Mellon approach grew out of the work of Herbert Simon and Alan Newell, the individuals who mid-century developed the first programs that actually worked in computers that actually solved logical or mathematical or chess problems. Siegler was the more Piaget developmentalist of their students in that he didn't care that much for the first part of his career in actually writing computer programs. Claren Wallis did. They are the major cognitive developmentalists who actually wrote computer programs which try to simulate exactly what happens when a conservation problem or balance beam problem is solved. And you will see the difference between a computationally influenced approach, an approach that is strictly computational. Then Jay McClelland, who will come up later when we talk about connections to approaches, is also at Carnegie Mellon, but he was one of the scientists who actually overthrew the more standard Simon, Newell, Siegler, Clark, Wallace, Case symbolic propositional approach to computing, what we often call the von Neumann one step at a time. The computer works very fast, but it does one operation at a time. McClelland with Rummelhart and other connectionists said that's just not a good way to understand cognition. If you want to understand how brains do it, we need a very different kind of computational architecture. And that's a story for another day. What Bob Siegler did with the balance beam was extremely interesting and had a lot of influence on psychology. In part because it comported more to intuitions about how people do things than most of these other approaches. What he did was, he said, I'm going to give kids a whole set of problems where they have to predict whether the balance beam is going to balance or not. And I'm going to look at the answers that the kids give. And if you show me all the answers the kids give, I'm going to tell you the rule the child is following. And so Sigler's argument was that what happens in kids in cognitive development, for example, when they're having a balance beam problem, is they invoke over time, over 3 or 5 years, a set of rules. And our job as cognitivists is to figure out what those rules are. And you can see that's a very psychologically compatible way of thinking about things. And I've summarized the rules here, but these are extended in your reading. The first rule, when you're young and foolish, 3, 4, 5 years old, you focus on one dimension. It's almost always the number of weights on the balance beam. So if there's more weights on one side than another, it's obvious to you that the one with the more weights is going to go down. And that's the only real rule that you follow. The second rule that you follow, let's say when you're 5 or 6 or 7, is you begin, and this would be called bidimensional in Robbie Case's terms, you begin to pay attention to more than one dimension. You pay attention to the number of weights, but also the distance from the fulcrum. So if you have the same number of weights on both sides, then and only then do you pay attention to how far the weights are from the fulcrum. And if they're further away, then you say it's going to go that way. The third stage, which you get mostly from kids 10 to 11, is they pay attention both to the weight and the distance, and they do it simultaneously. But if the weight tells you one thing and the distance tells you another, you don't know what to do. So let's say you got 3 pegs on one side and they're 4 steps apart, and you've got 4 weights on the other side and they're 2 steps apart from the fulcrum, the child doesn't know what to do. He's just confused, and so he guesses. Contrary-wise, the person who is at rule 4, and who at least, if they were on their toes, would always get it right, realizes that that a qualitative judgment isn't enough. You can't say, well, it looks like there's more over here, but the distance seems greater, so I'm going to choose this one. You actually count and say, well, there's 12 points on one side and 8 on the other, and so the one with 12 is going to fall down. So you basically take what would be a qualitative judgment, like it looks that way, to I'm going to count number of items, how far away they are, and I will know whether or not it's going to balance. And if you think about it, this applies perfectly well to the nulting problem. Though I'm not going to, I'm going to now see whether I can actually think well about it live. But you know, initially just pay attention to how much juice there is. Then maybe if there's, maybe if that doesn't give you the answer alone, you also pay attention to how much water there is. And if you have, you're moving to a third step, if you mix juice and water together and, you know, there's more juice in one set and there's more water in the other, you say, well, I think that it's going to work in favor of the juice, but I'm not sure because there may not be that much more juice compared to water in the two sets. Whereas, and here we're on safer ground, when you talk about compute the torque, you simply deal with proportionality. You say that out of 100 bits of liquid, this has got 47% juice and this has got 49% juice, so obviously that one is going to be sweeter, QED. As Piaget would say, necessity, not just guessing. My very bumbling here is probably very valuable because at the risk of being unfair to all these people, Sigler, Fisher, and Case, they've got a kind of Procrustean problem. Namely, they've got a problem, they've got to pick a task from the Piaget repertoire, and they've got to lay out a bunch of steps, and they would like the steps to relate more or less to Piaget's stages and structures. That's more important for Fisher, and it's most important for Case, somewhat important for Fisher, not very important for Sigler, but they've all got that in the back of their mind, and so, excuse me, they like those problems which lend themselves to about four rules or four steps, and ones where it's pretty clear what moves are being made. The nice thing, again, about Siegler is if he figures out what the rule is that the child is following, then if you give the child a new problem, you can predict how the child's going to answer. And if your prediction is wrong, then you haven't got the rules worked out properly. So that's very nice, and people like that. Since then, Siegler's own thinking has developed, and he now believes that kids don't have just one rule. They have what he would call a bunch of strategies. And maybe they're kids who contain a number of these strategies at the same time, and these strategies compete with each other in kind of a Darwinian way to see which one will win. And since evolution is more and more a metaphor that's being used throughout the sciences and the humanities nowadays, it's perhaps not surprising that rather than thinking of the rules as following one after another, we tend to think more of kids having a bunch of different strategies. And what happens over time is that certain strategies get foregrounded. So one of the things that Siegler has looked at is how kids add, 7 plus 2, 3 plus 6, and so on. And while hopefully that's not trouble for anybody in this class, it's difficult for young kids. But it's not the case that kids follow one rule for a while and then for another rule. Often kids will have remembered certain numbers, certain sums. They remember 2 and 2 is 4, so they just look it up, so to speak. Sometimes they'll count with their fingers, 1, 2, 3, 4. Sometimes they'll say, what's the larger number, 7, and we'll add 2 to that, rather than what's the smaller number, 2, and add 7, which is much more of a burden on memory. Sometimes they'll break it down into smaller problems. If 7 plus 9 is too big, let's add 7 plus 6 and 7, and then add 3 more. And the kids will have all those strategies, and then what happens over time is certain strategies do better, or kids get more efficient, or they like them better, and so those last and the other ones drop out. I have anticipated the next slide, though I also include a misspelling here. One of the things that Siegler did, good American style, was to show that if kids were at rule number 1, you could help them get to rule number 2. You couldn't get to rule number 4, but you could create conflicts where the predictions didn't work and they would see, well, maybe I can't just pay attention to the weight. I've got to look at how far the thing is as well. He looked at a range of strategies used in things like adding. If you want to read about good, not so good, and perfectionism, look at the readings. And he developed a more evolutionary view, which is that there's a kind of a Darwinian struggle between strategies. And if you think about anything where you have lots of different ways of doing it, eventually certain ones become the preferred ones because, in general, they work the best. I mean, there are 45 ways that I have of going home, but I tend to use one or two of them because they're most likely, on the average, to work. But if I know there's construction going on or there's a traffic jam or Vice President Gore is visiting Marty Peretz, which we'll tell you when this lecture was made, who lives in my block, then I will go another way. Carr and Wallace are the purists, which means that they're the ones who actually are doing what Simon and Newell would like them to do. They actually are writing computer programs which exactly simulate what a human organism does when that human organism is trying to solve a conservation problem or a balance beam problem. This means they have to be incredibly precise. They can't leave anything to chance. And they have to make very definite assumptions about what information is getting in and in what form it's getting in. It's a much less sloppy process than either Siegler or Case, or for that matter, Fisher would use. If you're not familiar with how computer programs work, you're going to have difficulty with Clar and Wallace, because they are basically computer programmers, and you'll have to decide yourself how much of the reading you want to do. I will try to describe what they're doing in lay language. Their particular approach they call is what's called a production system approach. A production system approach basically says, and I'm anthropomorphizing here, if the following set of conditions exist, do that. If the conditions don't exist, do nothing, or go to plan P or plan X or whatever. If conditions exist for two different things, then it's not clear what to do, so there's got to be some program which says that if both production systems 1 and 2 could work, always do number 1 before number 2, or always do number 2 before number 1. At a very elementary level, these are like stimulus responses. You don't respond unless a certain stimulus is presented. Similarly, the production system doesn't produce, it doesn't act, unless a certain set of conditions exist. And so, what you have to do in a production system is to figure out all the conditions which would possibly arise for somebody who is solving a problem. And then, when the first condition is present, the action is carried out. And then you look at what the current situation is, because that will change the situation, and then you do whatever the rule says you do under that second circumstance, and so on. That's how a production system works. Conditions followed by actions, and they can get in loops, or they can break down, but hopefully neither of those things will happen. Eventually you'll come up with a problem solution, be it a good or a bad one. Now, these folks, however, are not cognitive psychologists. They're cognitive developmentalists. So they've got to try to develop a production system which, so to speak, learns from its mistakes. Otherwise, it would be stage 1A forever. And so they use the notion self-modifying production system, which means in intuitive language the actual rules of the production system change based on the nature of the experience at trial 1 or trial N. It's very much like Siegler. If Siegler presents you a bunch of cases where your prediction of focusing only on the weight doesn't work, eventually you'll kind of scratch your head and say, well, maybe I should focus on something else instead, like the color of the blocks, or you know, what the weather is like outside, or maybe the distance from the fulcrum. These are all possibilities. So what happens in a self-modifying production system is that the productions themselves are changed. For example, if a whole bunch of trials all yield the same result, the production system becomes able to generalize and says, under all these conditions, I will do a certain thing because it applies to all conditions. So that would be a generalization which the production system can do. The production system can also remember, and so it can say, if I have a certain number of things in memory, then I'm going to do this rather than that. So a production system basically has rewrite rules, which says under certain conditions I will change my rules because that will make it better to easier to solve the problem. And that's what happens to kids when they get better at a balance beam problem, or in this case of Siegler and strategies, if you know the notion of counting on fingers makes lots of mistakes, then the production system says don't use counting on fingers anymore. That's a bad approach. And here are the some of the more specific things which you can look at in the reading. If the self-modifying mechanism is generalization, it can look at things as how they unfold over time, which is very important, the history of what happened in previous trials. It can look for regularities. That's what I was referring to earlier, things that happen over and over again. And it can also get rid of redundancies. You don't have to both count on your fingers and remember the answer if they both give you the right answer. If you remember the answer, it's enough. You can forget about counting on your fingers. It's not necessary anymore. And what makes the self-modifying system modify in a child developmental way is when it figures out what to do when two systems can't both work. Which one should it focus on, in which order, or when productions which were previously separate get combined because they work well together. This is very interesting. It's a lot of fun. Anybody who knows something about programming would want to try his or her hand at the production system approach. And yet, from the point of view of developmental psychology, we have to ask a bigger question at the end of the day. And the bigger question is, do we learn anything new about kids from these particular approaches? Well, clearly, if you have any skill in computer programming, it's fun to try to do what Clark and Wallace have done and to write programs which more or less seem to simulate what kids do. But in science, we have to ask a different question, which is our knowledge enhanced by this process? And have we learned something new about kids, which we didn't know about before, how their mind works? And I would say, with the benefit of 25 years of looking back at this research, that this is an existence proof. This basically shows that, yes, we can get computers to do things which look, roughly speaking, like what kids do. But in the case of the Piagetian tasks, we haven't really learned anything new about kids as a result of these simulations. And so they're really not done very much anymore, except as exercises. I think when it comes to things like spelling. There have been programs which have been invented which actually do help us understand the problems that kids have with spelling, and those can be used for educational purposes. But that hasn't been the case for the Clark and Wallace demonstrations, to my knowledge. This brings us to a final comment, which is to call to your attention another document, which is probably the most argued about paper in the whole area of cognitive science. It came out about 20 years ago. It came out in various forms. It's typically called the Chinese Room Problem. It was put forth by a philosopher named John Searle, who is a very good philosopher and one who's extremely interested in cognitive science and has written illuminatingly about it. But it is a deep critique about what it is that we really learn when we take a look at what computers can do. And Searle has no objection to what he calls weak AI, which is when you create a program that can do something well. He says that's fine, we can learn a lot from that, and maybe if it can do something we don't want to do, like clean our car, that's great. But he has a lot of objection to what he calls strong AI, which is the claim that computers actually know things in the way that we know them. He feels that that is a category error and that it's foolish to think that something that's made of silicon and was programmed by somebody has knowledge at all, in the sense that flesh and blood that have developed over the years can know something. Indeed, he's very interested in consciousness, has written a lot about it. He says consciousness is the stuff of brains. It's the stuff of a certain kind of 3 pounds of wetness in our head, and the notion that a computer would be conscious, he thinks, is silly. Now, the point about the Chinese room example, and I'm not going to pass judgment on it, I'm simply going to tell it to you, is to say that, let's say that you had a person sitting in a room, and the person who was sitting in the room did not know a word of Chinese. But all the person had was a list of symbols, which whenever that set of symbols was exposed to the person, they would issue another set of symbols. And let's say the set was infinitely long, so any set of symbols which was produced to the person would come out with the appropriate set of symbols. It's like any input, the person in the Chinese room would come up with an appropriate output. From the point of view of somebody on the outside, we would inevitably conclude that that person understood Chinese, just like anybody else who speaks appropriately in China speaks Chinese. And we would say this person passed the Turing test with flying colors. Searle says that, however, it's nonsense to say the person understands Chinese. He says, I could be that person, I could get all the symbols right, I don't know a word of Chinese and never will. And that's because all I am is a syntactic, no, sorry, all the man in the Chinese room is a syntactic is a syntactic processing mechanism. Namely, if you give me a bunch of characters, I will give you another set of characters. And the whole notion of meaning, understanding, semantics is completely absent, not only for this guy in this particular Chinese room, as he calls it, but for any computer. Any computer is just a bunch of operations, understanding, knowing, having ideas. All that sort of stuff is something which will be forever forbidden to man-made machines. Only people made of flesh and blood like us can do it. Now you might say, well, is he a mystic or is he a magician? And the answer is not at all. I don't think he believes that human beings have any godlike character, any kind of magic character. Moreover, he doesn't preclude that we could create silicon that would be like human cells and DNA and so on, but then we would really have created another member of our species, not something which is basically in his mind a number-crunching or character-matching system. So whether you like this argument or dislike it, and a lot more people hate it than like it, you should read the John Searle's Chinese Room Problem and some of the comments on it and see whether it enhances your own ideas about the topic.